postdoc at San Diego. As a tourist, it sounds like in Seattle, on the way to MIT. Time there, not a rank. So he'll be telling us about the effective field theory methods and new tools for understanding the strong interactions.
Thanks. Can you turn off the lights maybe in the front here? So here's my outline. I'm going to talk about new tools, and these tools are based on the concepts of effective field theory. And I'm going to introduce these concepts to you with something that you're all familiar with, namely the system of hydrogen. So we'll study QED, and I'll build up a language of effective field theory in this framework of hydrogen, telling you things that you're already familiar with, but changing the words a little bit, just so it makes it easier to go beyond QED to things that you may be less familiar with. So we'll talk also about QCD. And then we'll talk about some of these new tools for QCD, about the theory of the strong interactions, in particular a tool called the soft planar effective theory, which helps in understanding the energetic limit of QCD. I'll give you a bunch of examples in using weak interactions, where a B meson decays weakly into other hadrons. And so I'll be talking about three forces here of the standard model, QED, QCD, and the weak interactions. And so I'll start by giving you some introduction to those forces. So here's my one-slide introduction to QED. QED combines together special relativity, space-time, and velocity much less, velocity less than or equal to c, and quantum mechanics, where we have quantization, Heisenberg uncertainties. From that, we get out antiparticles, spin, and gauge theory. QED is a gauge theory of a U1 gauge boson. And the parameters of this theory are charges and masses. So we describe the interactions of this theory with things called Feynman diagrams. That's a nice way of doing it. So if we want to have interactions between a negative charged electron and a positron, which is positively charged, we can have a photon mediating the exchange, and that gives a potential. This interaction here is proportional to two factors of the charge. That's giving us E squared, and it's attractive, and we have a minus sign here. If we have two electrons, we have a repulsive potential. That's not all QED can do. It can give more than just the familiar potentials of quantum mechanics. It can also be responsible for annihilation of a positron and electron to photon, or pair creation from a photon. Photon fluctuates into an electron and a positron. So a particle number is not conserved in this theory, unlike in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. The standard model of interactions builds together QED, QCD, and the weak force. So in my talk, I'm going to be talking about these three forces. I won't be talking much about gravity or Higgs, because there are other forces that we know exist in nature. So in QED, we talked about how photons are mediating the force. And the interaction strength of QED in units where the QCD force, which is stronger, is order 1, the interaction strength is of order 10 to the minus 2. The mediator and QCD are the gluons. And the range of the forces in these different theories is also quite different. QED interacts over infinite range. So no matter how far apart you take your test particles, there'll be a force between them. And it's just responsible for the familiar electric field and magnetic field that we learn about. QCD, on the other hand, is a short-range force of order of Fermi. And it's what binds together the quarks and gluons into hadrons like the proton. The weak forces, on the other hand, are mediated by particles known as the W and Z. They have an even weaker interaction strength, therefore the name weak. This is, in this case, caused by the fact that the W is so massive. And the range of the force here is 10 to the minus 3 Fermis. And they're responsible for things like radioactive decay. So you could have things like a B quark changing into a charm quark with a W. That's an example of a radioactive decay in quarks rather than in nuclei. And W bosons can pair create a neutrino and electron. Other forces in nature can, in principle, be derived from these. And starting from these, you can derive the forces that are relevant for chemistry. And so that's a paradigm that we often teach our students. We think about physics in this way. We start with the low here. In the first year courses, we teach classical mechanics and classical electricity and magnetism. And then we build up this little chain towards the top, towards a theory where we combine together quantum field theory and general relativity, something that's string theory, or maybe loop quantum gravity, some description of quantum gravity that combines together everything. And this is a way of describing physics where we also go from long distance to short distance. Long distance is us standing around in this room, knocking on the table. And as we go to shorter distance, we get things like chemistry and then combine together to atoms, the nuclei. Going to even shorter distance, we get QCD, and then the electroweak force, and finally quantum gravity. That's a very nice description, but it's not always the best description of how to do physics, because often it's better to use one of these theories down here to do actual calculations than it is to use the theory that sits at the top. It's a question of generality versus precision. Going up this chain, you get into more general theories, but there might be theories where it's harder to calculate things. And so you actually might find it much easier to calculate down here. So the example I give is that a boat is built of nuclei, like this one, full of protons and nuclei, neutrons. But if you were in a boat race, you wouldn't want to spend much time thinking about nuclear physics. You'd want to think about classical mechanics, because that's what would win you the race, rigging the sail and guiding your boat through the water, not thinking about what the boat is made of. So sometimes the right thing to think about is not to think about the most general possible approach, but rather, how can I make a more precise approach? And that's actually part of what's behind the idea of effective field theory. The dynamics at long distance actually doesn't care much about what happens at short distance. There's a decoupling between long distance and short distance. In quantum physics, the wavelength is related to 1 over the momentum, and so you can change the statement about long and short distance, long being the boat, short being the nuclei, into a statement about energy. So long and short distance become low energy interactions, do not depend on the details of high energy. This is actually bad, because it means if we want to understand something like quantum gravity, or we want to see short distance things, we have to really work hard. We have to probe this interesting short distance physics, and we have to work hard to do it. We can't just do experiments at long distance. It's good, on the other hand, because it means that we can really focus on the relevant interactions and degrees of freedom. If we want to describe something like how a boat moves through water, we don't need to understand the constituents of the boat, which simplifies calculations. So if you were Newton and you thought about this, you might make the statement that when Newton was studying the apple, he didn't need to understand quantum gravity. Phew. Lucky for Newton. He really just needed to understand the classical picture of things. He didn't need to understand all the things that are inside it in order to understand classical gravity. So let me now take you through an example, which is hydrogen, and take you through some of the steps of building up an effective field theory in a familiar setting. So hydrogen is just the physics of non-relativistic quantum mechanics. The relevant parameters are the mass of the electron, the charges, which are the charge of the electron, the charge of the proton, and the coupling constant, fine structure constant. The degrees of freedom are just that proton and electron. And we have a probabilistic description. The scales in the problem are the mass of the proton. Well, I'm actually going to take that mass of the proton and send it to infinity. So that's not going to be really a scale of the problem. The mass of the electron, half an MeV, is going to play a role. The typical momentum of the particle of the photons that are mediating the force in the hydrogen atom is of order Me times alpha, which is the inverse Bohr radius. And that's the scale that's important, 3.7 keV. And then finally, a formula that should be very familiar to you, the Bohr energy levels, just 13.6 over m squared. And that's also another scale, which is Me alpha squared, down by yet another alpha from this keV scale. So those are the scales in the problem, and those are the degrees of freedom, the electron and the proton. And you might ask, well, I know more than I knew when I taught myself non-relativistic quantum mechanics. I know that the proton is made of quarks. Why don't I have to deal with quarks in this problem? Why don't I have to deal with QCD? The photons are coupling to the quarks, the charge of the quarks, not necessarily just the charge of the proton. What about the B quark? That's another quark. Why didn't I have to include that as a degree of freedom here? Or even simpler, what about the positron? I know that there's not just electrons, but there's also positrons. Why don't I need that force here? Weak forces, other things. Why was I allowed to get rid of this proton mass? Why don't I have to deal with spin? And all these things can be included in this non-relativistic framework. It's just that they're corrections, perturbations on this energy formula. And the idea is that we don't have to ignore these things. We can include them if we want. And when we include them, we would include them as correction terms to this energy. That's the basic idea behind effective field theory, that you can organize things in an expansion. So in this non-relativistic system of hydrogen, you would expand the momentum over the mass of the electron, the mass of the electron over the mass of the proton, and the fine structure constant. You could start with a general theory, in this case QED. It's a general short-distance field theory. And you could expand it, and therefore get a non-relativistic field theory, that non-relativistic field theory is a generalization of non-relativistic quantum mechanics, which is a field theory that I call non-relativistic QED. And the first term in that series is just non-relativistic quantum mechanics. But then doing an expansion in some small parameters that I call epsilon, I can get corrections to that picture. And the nice thing about this is that if I'm doing bound states, even in QED, bound states are much easier in a non-relativistic framework. So this long-distance theory that we use for hydrogen is actually a much easier theory to compute it than the full QED theory. With this paradigm, you're not after computing the exact answer. You're actually only interested in working at a desired level of precision. So you might worry about the fact that you have an infinite here, an infinite number of terms, infinite number of Hamiltonians that are correcting your leading order description. But it doesn't matter because each higher order terms in this series are suppressed by parameter epsilon. So I only need to work to the number of digits that the experimentalist has given me, and I can always truncate this series to a finite number of terms. So I'm only interested in making predictions at a certain level of precision. Now, it's not as simple as just taking a field theory and expanding it. Various things can happen. One thing that can happen is the degrees of freedom can change. So in this theory of QED, the positron and the electron are really very complementary. But when I pass through the non-relativistic description, there's no positron at all. We just have the electron. In QED, I might describe the coupling of electromagnetism to quarks, and I might have to include QCD as well. But we know in the non-relativistic description of hydrogen that we just have a proton. So these degrees of freedom have changed into a proton. Symmetries of QED also can constrain the form of non-relativistic QED. So when we make this arrow, if there's some symmetries up here, like charge conjugation, pairing, or time reversal, those symmetries will constrain the form of these Hamiltonians that can appear. So if you talk about parity-violating interactions, those will be particular Hamiltonians that can only come from weak forces because QED preserves parity, et cetera. Okay, so even when we make this passage, we can still retain a lot of information about this theory because we can do this passage, we know about this theory, and we can really do this analytically, go down this arrow. So it's not like we're really losing information. We're just describing the physics of this upper theory in a more convenient framework. In the energy spectrum of hydrogen, which I show you here, if I just consider the Bohr energy spectrum, then of course the 2s and the 2p levels are degenerate. I'm using this spectroscopic notation, NLJ, so J is the total of the orbital angular momentum of the electron plus the spin, and then I have F, which is adding together the spin of the proton as well. So in the Bohr spectrum, we have a lot of degeneracy, but then when we pass to the real world, we see all the energy levels are splitting. So Bohr was energy shifts of order ME alpha squared. There's fine structure, which shifts this p level part into a 2p 3 halves, j equals 3 halves, and j equals 1 half state. There's the Lamb shift, the famous Lamb shift, which is an ME alpha to the fifth correction with a log of alpha. All the parameters that appear in this correction, this Lamb shift correction of 1058 megahertz, are fixed by QED. So it's not that I need any new information in order to make this prediction. The mass of the electron and alpha are parameters of QED, and I can just calculate what that number is. Same for these fine structure corrections. When I turn to these other corrections, these other splittings of F equals 1 and F equals 0, which are spin-spin couplings between the electron and proton, called hyperfine splittings, then I actually have parameters that are showing up that are not simply parameters that I have in QED alone, namely the mass of the proton. The mass of the proton is something I could calculate with QCD. It's not a fundamental parameter of QCD, but it could be calculated with QCD. And I also have the magnetic moment of the proton showing up in the expression for these hyperfine splittings. So these would all be corrections to the leading order Hamiltonian, which was giving us these Bohr energy couples. And in fact, that's the way that these corrections are usually taught in an undergraduate course. So we would compute relativistic corrections by putting in P4 Hamiltonians. We could compute other corrections like spin orbit corrections by putting in Hamiltonians for them. And in that way, make this passage from QED to NRQED. The nice thing is because we can calculate in this theory that we can actually just figure out exactly what these Hamiltonians are and we can build them up systematically. What about the quarks? Let's come back to that question. So we have up quarks, which are charged plus 2/3, and down quarks, which are charged minus 1/3. And if I look at a proton, then the important thing here is that the size of this proton is of order of Fermi. That translates into an energy scale of 200 MeV. And remember, the typical momentum of the photons in this hydrogen atom were keV, much smaller. These low momentum photons really don't resolve the individual quarks. They just see the total charge. And so when you do these matching steps, the couplings can change. Instead of talking about these fundamental couplings of electromagnetism to quarks, you're now talking about a different coupling, the charge of the proton. And that's not something unfamiliar. That's just the familiar multiple expansion that you learn about in electromagnetism. If you have a charge distribution with field lines, so I've got negative charges, which are red, and positive charges, which are blue, and you look at that charge distribution at a resolution where you can tell apart the distance between these different charges, you'll see something complicated that looks like this, various field lines. If you zoom out, then you'll see something simple that looks like this. So at short distance, it looks complicated, but at long distance, you're just really measuring the total charge of all those particles. And this is it in the formula, that the potential at long distance is just given by the total charge, and then corrections to that, a dipole term, et cetera. We have some charge distribution which is in radius r prime, and if we look at large r and expand in r prime much less than r, that's the same thing as expanding into 200 MeV for the proton, much greater than the photon momentum, because remember 1 over r is equal to p, so the much less than here becomes much greater than there. And that's exactly what's going on when we have this idea that the only thing that's relevant in hydrogen is the total charge of the proton, adding up all the charges of all the particles, which might be the constituent up down quark in the proton, as well as all sorts of quantum fluctuations. All that really matters is the total charge, and the total charge is the plus one for the proton. Okay, so sometimes this matching can be a little more complicated, but in the end, we really do have this passage from up and down charges to the charge of the proton. The other parameters could be thought of in a similar way. We could get parameters in the low energy description, which are the mass of the proton, the magnetic moment of the proton. In principle, one could fix those by QCD calculations, but actually that's not the way we do it most of the time. Most of the time, we actually just use experimental measurements. This is an example, the mass of the proton and the magnetic moment, where these parameters are measured enormously accurately by experimentalists. And it would be foolish to try to say that we have to rely on the theory. The thing we can rely on is a concept called universality. We can match onto these parameters, and once we've determined them from one process, they're just a universal parameter of this low energy theory. I can measure the mass of the proton, and then I can just use it. And the same with the magnetic moment. So sometimes it's much more advantageous to use that concept of universality, that these low energy parameters are really universal and describing lots of different things. It's more useful to use that than to try to say that I should always calculate them from a more fundamental theory. We'll see other examples of this concept of universality later on. The next concept I'd like to talk about is the concept of resolution. The interactions in quantum field theory depend on the resolution at which you resolve them. To give you an example of that, let's talk about vacuum polarization in QED. So I told you that photons not only can mediate forces between positive and negatively charged, giving our familiar electric fields and magnetic fields, but they can also fluctuate into or create an electron and a positron. Well, what happens if a photon creates an electron and a positron and then it fluctuates back into a photon? That can happen. And that actually changes the nature of charge. The way you can think about that is that you have some bare charge, and this fluctuation into charged electrons and positrons is like building up a dielectric medium. So we have little negatively and positively charged dielectric dipoles here, building up a dielectric. And those dipoles are going to mostly align. These are vacuum fluctuations, so they're coming out of nowhere. But they're mostly going to align with their positively charged pointing towards the negatively charged. Maybe not all of them, but most of them. And so depending on how closely we observe this charge, at what resolution we use, the value of charge that we'll measure is different, just like in a dielectric. Depending on the dielectric medium affects the charge. In this case, it's energy-dependent effect. And so I'm going to call that a resolution parameter mu. And in fact, in quantum field theory, we can calculate exactly what happens. The coupling changes according to an equation known as the anomalous dimension equation, this equation here. And so at larger energies, we probe shorter distances, we see more closer inside to this fundamental charge, and in this picture of vacuum polarization, we just see a larger charge. So if I plot 1 over alpha, then it should go down because alpha is going up. Hydrogen is the familiar 1 over 137. These effects are really turning on when I get above the mass of the electron, because that's where these fluctuations into electron and positron become important. And this equation here has a solution such that 1 over alpha is linear, and the charge just grows. It's not a very big effect. As you can see, I'm going from 137 to 135.5 when I go from energy scales of water hydrogen to 1,000 MeV. So it's a very, very gentle effect. But the basic point of this is that the resolution does matter. If I look at a photon at long wavelength, it's going to behave a little bit differently than a photon at short wavelength. This type of effect is also important in the Lamb shift, and I want to describe that to you. In fact, the very first calculations of the Lamb shift made use of this idea of short distance and long distance. It might be one of the first examples of an effective field theory really being used, although it wasn't called that back then. The weak interactions were also an early example. So let me describe to you the way in which the original Lamb shift calculations were really an effective field theory calculation. Those calculations were done in the following way. Beta computed this long distance contribution to the Lamb shift. This long distance contribution is coming from very soft photons coupling to the bound state. So these two lines here are supposed to be by hydrogen bound state. And they give a correction which in quantum mechanics looks like this. So this is just some quantum mechanical matrix element of the momentum operator. And it depends on some cutoff. And that's because there's another type of effect, which are short distance effects. And those short distance effects, you can think of those as effective potentials, not just the standard Coulomb potential, but higher order potentials in my expansion of the Hamiltonian. And exactly how I distinguish between what's short and what long, what is long, means drawing a line. I have to draw a line in momentum space and say below that line is long distance, low momentum, and above that line is short distance, high momentum. And that line I'm drawing with a parameter mu. So the parameter mu is dividing up short and long for me. And in the end of the day, the division, of course, is where I draw the line doesn't matter. So the short distance piece here is canceling, the effect of mu is canceling between these two terms, the short distance term and the long distance terms. The answer, the total sum, is independent of where I draw the line. But drawing the line is a very useful thing to do because it allows us to distinguish different types of physics, the physics going on at short distance and the physics going on at long distance. And that's actually how the calculation was done. Beta, on his train ride, computed only this second piece. And he computed that second piece, and he said, physically, I know that I should take this cutoff to be of orderly mass of the electron. And he just included only that part of the calculation. That has a log of ME over the typical splitting between energy levels, which is ME alpha squared. And that large log enabled beta to get most of the answer from just the second piece, because the logs in the first piece are small when you take mu to be of order ME. 2 years later, various people computed the full answer, computed the short distance piece as well, combining it together with this long distance piece. As numbers go, the answer that beta got was this 1040 megahertz, and that's very close to the experimental number of 1058. And when the full calculation was done of the short distance piece as well, then we got from 1040 up to 1051, we got an extra 11 megahertz from the short distance piece, getting us closer to the 1058 experimental answer. So that's an example of how this resolution parameter can really help us, because it helps to organize the calculation of the short and the long distance pieces, pieces which are physically very different, and enables us to do calculations efficiently. In a modern language, people talk a lot about using QED to do these calculations, but now the very high precision calculations that are done in the QED literature are done in exactly the same way beta did. They're split between long distance and short distance pieces, and people calculate these pieces individually and then combine them together using suitable resolution parameters. So I'm showing you here some examples of higher order terms in the QED perturbation theory. This alpha fifth log alpha term is the Lamb shift that we just talked about. And it turns out that these log alphas are kind of interesting because they are coming from a ratio of energy scales in the hydrogen atom. And there's actually renormalization group equations that one can derive that describe where these logs come from. This is some work that I did. And basically, what you need in this case is that you have a dispersion relation in a non-relativistic system that relates energy to momentum square. So it's not like the usual relativistic dispersion relation. And that changes how this renormalization group works a little bit. Instead of having one resolution, you need two. You need one for energy and one for momenta. And there's a relation between them shown here. Mu e is equal to mu p squared over f. But building in that complication, one can actually get a renormalization group description of all these logs that are appearing in the hydrogen atom. And you get series of them that you can actually calculate very simply from these anomalous dimension equations that I mentioned. And at lowest order, you get the Lamb shift. And at higher order, you get this series of terms. And they all actually come from just one equation. In the original QED literature, these terms were calculated one at a time, piece by piece. But actually, you can make relations between them by having a more general understanding, an effective field theory understanding of how these QED atoms work. Here are some numbers for you. Now, if you actually go and calculate numbers, it's not only the logs that are important, but also the constants under the logs. And you're going to have to work harder to do those calculations. And some of these calculations are some of the most precise things that we've both experimentally measured and theoretically calculated. In these bound states of hydrogen and the similar bound state of muonium and positronium, we can calculate these Lamb shifts, the hyperfine splittings at higher order in the perturbative expansions. And I'm quoting here the current experimental and theoretical predictions. So you can see that we're doing quite well at the level that we can predict things in theory. The Lamb shift is agreeing. This is alpha at the level of alpha 8 corrections. Hyperfine splitting is measured enormously well experimentally, but theoretically we have some more problems with nuclear effects. The hyperfine splitting in muonium is actually giving us the mass of the electron to the mass of the muon, so that's just used to determine that parameter. One thing that's not working, for example, is the hyperfine splitting. There's actually a 3-sigma disagreement that nobody understands exactly why that is, but there's a 3-sigma disagreement in a positronium system that's been around for years and is still there. There used to be a puzzle called the ortho-positronium puzzle, which was actually 6-sigma and caused people even more thought. But that has now gone away. A couple of years ago, that went away. It was the experimental number in that case that changed. The theorists stuck with their number, stuck to their guns, and won out. Okay, so this is QED for you. And the things that I've talked about here, the resolution parameter, the changes of degrees of freedom, the fixing of the couplings, making expansions, having multiple scales, and also this concept of universality, they become even more crucial for QCD, describing QCD in detail. And so that's like what I would like to turn to next. In QCD, things do change a bit. And one thing, the most important change is that the gluons are now charged, so they can interact with each other. So we have 3-gluon and 4-gluon interactions. The pointer is kind of dying. Here, I'll switch to the hockey stick. I have to hold it like a Canadian. In this, we have the vacuum response here, just like we had in the QED calculation. And the vacuum response is actually different than in hydrogen. In this case, the vacuum response is the opposite. And the reason is because the gluons carry spin, and they carry color charge, they actually behave like a permanent magnet, and they anti-screen the charge, the electric charge. They screen the magnetic charge. Okay? And so what that means in equations is that this anomalous dimension equation, the right-hand side of it switches sign. And that's very important. That actually drives a lot of the physics in QCD. Because it means that when I measure the coupling constant at large energy, it gets smaller, unlike in QED, where it gets bigger. And in fact, in QCD, the change is enormous. If I go from 100 GeV here, where I have a coupling of 0.1, down to some scale of order of GeV, it's really just blowing up. It's becoming something that I would not want to expand it. Okay, down here. And so, of course, there was a Nobel Prize given for the calculation of this curve, which agrees very well with the data. At large energies, we have a small coupling. We have free quarks when we look at very short distance. At low energy, we have what's called infrared slavery. And what happens is that the coupling effects get very large. There's a large change in the value. And so picking the right resolution, picking the right scale for this coupling is very important. The fact that the coupling gets very large at very low momentum is, in fact, responsible for the idea of confinement. So what happens at very low momentum is that the quarks can't escape. These quarks, when we try to pull them apart and try to go to larger distances or lower momentum, the coupling gets so strong that they're bound together into hadrons, the mesons and the baryons. So two quarks gives it a meson, three quarks gives it a baryon. The degrees of freedom here change. So what we observe in our detectors, because of this effect of confinement, are mesons and baryons, not three quarks. Okay, so it's a very important effect. Everything that the experimentalist measures has to do with QCD, has to do with these mesons and baryons that are hitting things in their detector. And in QCD, this idea of effective field theory is very broad. Depending on what limit of QCD you take, you get different effective field theories. So if you're talking about bound states with a heavy quark and a light quark, you'd be talking about a theory called heavy quark effective theory. If you're talking about pions, the theory that you would use is a theory called chiral perturbation theory. Finite temperature, there's another effective theory for that, et cetera, et cetera. The one I want to talk about here is this theory for jets and energetic hadrons, which is called the soft collinear effective theory. So that's one of the effective theory that I'm going to focus on. And not to leave lattice out of the picture, I should say that if we want to calculate really properties of these low energy mesons and baryons, then combining together these ideas of effective field theory with lattice QCD calculations is very important, because what the lattice can do is concentrate on the non-perturbative part of the problem, and the effective theory tells you what the non-perturbative part of the problem is, and what part of the problem is really a short distance part. And so we can organize things according to distance scale, or mass scale, as its axis shows. And in nature, it's provided us with quarks of very different masses. So it gives us physics at a lot of different distance scales. We have light quarks that are lighter than the confinement scale. And then we have heavy quarks, like the charm on the bottom. And we also have a very heavy quark, the top quark, sitting up here above the W mass. And what we'd like to probe is actually physics at even higher scales. And we can try to use, for example, these quarks to do it. Now, if you want to understand QCD, you might ask the question, well, is there something like a hydrogen atom? That allowed us to understand so much about QED. And there's not actually one good candidate, but let me tell you of three possible things that you might think of. Well, you might think of using the top quark, because it's so heavy, and it's so much above this confinement scale, maybe that will help us to build a state that looks like a hydrogen atom. Or you might think of just doing a proton, taking some of these light quarks below the confinement scale. That's a fairly simple thing. Or maybe you should take something that really looks like hydrogen and has one heavy particle, like the proton, like a B quark, and one light particle down here, a D quark. That would be like the analog of having one light electron and one heavy proton. So that's three examples, and I'll talk about those three cases because they each teach us something about QCD. Let's first talk about this TT bar example. Well, it turns out that if you do E plus E minus to TT bar, and you sit close to threshold so that the TT bar are really non-relativistic, then it does behave like a non-relativistic QCD bound state. Great. We have a mass scale, it's 175 GeV. Momentum is m times alpha s, and that's somewhere down at 25 GeV. And energies are m times alpha s squared, and that's somewhere down at 4 GeV. Still bigger than this lambda QCD scale. And in fact, the width of the top quark is also bigger than the lambda QCD scale. And the top quarks really decay before they have any chance to be sensitive to this lambda QCD scale. So they really behave like a Coulombic system. And so we can just go and calculate the same way we do in hydrogen. And so what you might try to calculate, for example, is the TT bar cross-section as you go through the threshold region. So this is energy going through the threshold region. 2m top would be about 350 GeV. And if you just go ahead and naively calculate, you'll get curves that look like this. And the problem with these curves is that there's no convergence. The leading order description is the description between these three blue lines. At next to leading order, it turns out things that start to look pretty good. But then at next to next to leading order, you're finding a big spread of curves again, and you're not really understanding what is going on. And the problem here is that you haven't fixed your resolution correctly if you just blindly apply perturbation theory. You have to know each time an alpha s shows up whether it's alpha s at m top, alpha s at pt, or alpha s at pt, because the strong coupling is changing by an enormous amount between these three scales. And you can derive an almost dimension equations that allow you to do that, and when you put in the proper scales for the couplings, you find nicely convergence results, the leading log next to leading log and next to leading log. giving us a very accurate prediction for this cross-section. And in fact, this is the most accurate way that people have proposed to measure MTOP. Unfortunately, it requires a linear collider, which we haven't decided to build yet. So that's something that you can learn. You can actually build a non-relativistic system, of course, TT bar. Another thing you can do is try to use protons. And actually, that's what we did first. When we really understood QCD, it came about from a process of deep inelastic scatter. And it came about from a process from a formula that looks like this one, which is actually a separation of distance scales between short distance, which is in this magenta, H, and a non-perturbative function. And it turns out this non-perturbative function is universal. In the same way our proton mass is universal. It appears in many places, and we only have to know it once, and then we can use it. In this case, it's a function, not a parameter, but it's universal in the same way the mass of the proton was in QED. The process that one is looking at here is electrons scattering through a virtual photon on a messy proton. But it turns out that this process is described by a simple formula like this one, in terms of a simple one-parameter function. And really what you can think of is that because what we're doing is we're scattering a very large momentum transfer here, we're probing the proton in a way that the quarks don't have a chance to really move around very much. So it's just like Bragg scattering. When you scatter a very energetic X-ray on the crystal, the motion of the atoms is kind of frozen in place, and you see something like this. It's the same idea. You're taking a snapshot of the proton, and that's what this large Q-squared is enabling you to do. Okay, so you can get information about the proton with this non-perturbative universal function, just like the mass of the proton gives us information about it. Bnesons provide a different way of getting information. Here you're looking at a bound state between a heavy quark and some light stuff, and you have decays of this B quark into all these lighter quarks by weak interactions. Weak interactions can change B to charm, they can change B to up, and they can make transitions down this scale. And in fact, the B is the heaviest particle that we know of that's bound and weakly decays. So we have a huge number of decays to look at. If you have a new particle data book this year and you wonder why it's doubled in size, it's a lot because of all the things that have been going on in B physics, and there's just been so many measurements that it just didn't that much thicker. Okay? And that's because the B factories have been pumping out data on all these decays. And so now it's a big, heavy book that you don't want to carry around with you. You didn't want to carry it around with you before, but now you really don't. So there's lots of different decays here. You can look at semi-leptonic decays. You can look at non-leptonic decays with two mesons in the final state, or purely photonic-leptonic channels, and study QCD by looking at these decays. So let me give you a little movie to show you how the different scales come into a problem in B physics. And I'll take a very simple decay of a B meson changing into a D meson, and that's a B quark changing into a charm quark. If I look at short distance, where the resolution is, can really see the W, then the process looks like this. The gluons at this scale are perturbative, and I don't need them, so I knock them out. If I zoom out to intermediate distance, then the W disappears. It shrinks to a point. And I just have a form Fermi interaction theory. The gluons are still perturbative. I'm now at this scale of the resolution being 5 GeV. If I zoom out further, then I get down to the scale where the gluons become non-perturbative. And then I can't leave them out. It's very important because those gluons are binding together a quark together with our B quark to make the B meson, and the same for the D meson. So the process would really need those non-perturbative gluons at this stage. If I zoom out yet further, then the B gets bound and it shrinks to a point, much like the proton did. And there's no gluons to describe this process at all. These are color singlet hadrons. Each of these descriptions, each of these pictures, can actually be described by a field theory. And much like we match QED and non-relativistic QED together, we can match these field theories together too. The advantage of doing that is that we can capture the most important physics at each stage and enable us to calculate in the most efficient fashion, making use of expansion parameters that appear like the coupling and lambda divided by MB, small expansion parameters that help us to organize the calculation. So this is an example of what is done in B physics to make high precision calculations. Let me turn to another effective theory, which is the one that I wanted to describe to you, called the soft cooling effective theory. This is an effective theory for energetic hadrons and jets. So in this case, what we do is we take energy to be much greater than lambda QCD, and we ask what happens to QCD in that limit. Well, in QED, what made things simple was to take the non-relativistic limit. In QCD, the coupling gets perturbative at large energy. And so you might think that what makes QCD simple is to take large energy. And in fact, that's true. And so in some sense, what SCT is giving for us is the analog of what quantum mechanics gave for us in QED. It's giving us a simplified description of QCD, because what it's allowing us to do is capture in the complicated parts of QCD directly in terms of fields in this effective theory, and take the things that we can compute in QCD and describe them simply as coupling constants. So it's allowing us to focus on the difficult part, okay? Which quantum mechanics also did in the Lamchuk calculation. When you had this long distance photon, that was a difficult calculation. Doing it in non-relativistic QED made it possible. Doing it in QED is much more difficult. So let me give you an idea of what this effective theory is about. If we take a process like a B meson changing into two pions, then the energy of those pions is quite great, 2.6 GeV, much greater than lambda QCD, and you might think of using that as an expansion parameter, and that's exactly what we're going to do. The B meson is built out of soft particles. If I just consider a B meson sitting there, the typical particles that are building up that B meson are soft gluons with momentum of order lambda QCD. On the other hand, this pion is very energetic. And so what happens is in this decay process, there's some quarks and gluons that stream out, and they bind themselves into a pion. They have typical perpendicular momentum that's of order lambda QCD, but their longitudinal momentum is much greater because it has to keep up with this very energetic pion. So think about a bunch of quarks and gluons streaming out from a point all in the same direction. They're within lambda QCD of each other, so they are attractive and they bind into a hadron, color singlet, but they all have a large longitudinal momentum. That's a very different momentum configuration than we have in the B meson itself, and we're going to describe it with a different set of fields, a different set of collinear degrees of freedom. If we want to describe a jet, it's not much more difficult. All we have to do is think about having the same large longitudinal momentum, but we make the transverse momentum a bit bigger. If the transverse momentum is much bigger than lambda QCD, then we're not going to hadronize into a single hadron. We're going to hadronize into a bunch of different hadrons. Pions, for example, maybe we'll get four of them. So the description of the physics of a jet and the physics of a hadron is not actually that different. It's just a matter of changing the perpendicular momentum. So the same effective field theory is going to be used for the description of these energetic hadrons as for energetic jets. So what this soft collinear effective theory is an effective theory that it organizes things in an expansion in lambda QCD divided by E. That's the analog of the non-relativistic expansion. And it provides certain things, like the interaction between the soft background fields and this energetic collinear fields is actually much simpler than it would be if you just tried to calculate with the QCD Lagrangian. There's certainly decoupling effects that happen when you have, much like we have this decoupling due to the multipole expansion in hydrogen. And these things allow calculations to move forward and become simpler. And the basic thing that one's getting out of doing this kind of tricks is formulas like this one I showed you for deep and elastic scattering. You're separating degrees of freedom, and you have some hard degrees of freedom, hard interactions, that are going into this coefficient function, and some low energy degrees of freedom, in this case I've called them collinear degrees of freedom, which are going into this non-perturbative function. There's a resolution parameter here, and you can think of that as just a line that I've drawn in space between some degrees of freedom. And that divides up who's hard and who's collinear. In this case, it's very important because these guys are non-perturbative gluons, and I want to separate them from the perturbative gluons that occur in this right here. So it's even more important than in our Lamchuk example. This formula has an integral. The reason it has an integral is because I could draw a line in this space. This space is momentum space, p minus and p plus. And there's a set of momentum in the description that I'm giving here where the collinear proton, the energetic that's moving energetically, has a momentum that's the same size as the momentum in the hard interactions. And because of that, you get a convolution. That's generically why all the convolutions that I'm going to show you in various formulas are showing up. It's because low energy degrees of freedom have at least one component of momentum that's the same size as the hard short distance degrees of freedom. So this effective theory provides a very simple operator language to derive formulas like this. And you should think of this formula like the formulas that we have in quantum mechanics, where you have some wave function, and then you have some coefficients. Okay, so this f is like a wave function. It's not really a wave function, but it's like the wave function in the way that it becomes useful, because we can actually measure it in one process and use it in others. It's not like quantum mechanics where we can calculate the wave function, but the universality of it, this non-perturbative function, is very useful. You could also calculate it on the lattice, but the lattice is able to do, actually, at this point, is only calculate moments of this function. They can't actually calculate the full function. So the SET is used in this way to derive new formulas for observables, analogs of formulas where you would have a wave function in quantum mechanics or these factorization theorems. And you can find these new universal hadronic functions. It's not always clear what it's going to be, but you can follow the formalism through and figure out what the function is, what type of wave function is it that is appearing in different processes. It's an effective theory, so you can just make a systematic expansion. Something that's been very difficult in QCD to do is to go beyond a leading order description. And this effective theory tells you how to do it. It also tells you how to track the mu dependence and therefore take into account large logarithms that are occurring, like in our top quark example, and thus reduce uncertainties. So let me just give you a few brief examples. One example is in the hadronic decays of B to D pi. It turns out in this process that the hadronic interactions factorize. The physics of the confining the pion together is factorizing from the physics of the B to D process. There's no gluons between these two things, only within them. And that actually leads to universal functions, a form factor type function and a distribution function for the pion, coupled together with some convolution in this variable t. So there's a formula that we could derive there. If I look at a similar process, but with neutral pions instead of charged pions, there's also a process that can be, a formula that can be derived here. It's more complicated, it has more integrals, and that's actually because it involves subleading interactions in the Hamiltonian, not leading order interactions in the Hamiltonian. But, and we can actually just, even though this formula has a lot of integrals, we can figure out which pieces are perturbative. This is perturbative, this is perturbative. Which pieces are non-perturbative? This is non-perturbative, this is non-perturbative. And we can study symmetries of these functions, and even without even doing any of these integrals, we can make some predictions. One thing that we were able to prove in this particular case is that this non-perturbative function S is the same for D bound states as it is for D star bound states. And we could use that to make some predictions that the amplitudes comparing D stars to D should be the same. And when you look at the data, it agreed very nicely with that prediction. This was something that before the advent of this formalism was thought to be a hopeless calculation because it's really involving subleading interactions in the power expansion, and that was just thought to be impossible. But here it is, agreeing nicely with the data. An even more important application is to weak interaction physics involving B to pi pi decays. The reason is because B to pi pi is a good way of looking at CP violation. So C is the exchange of particles and antiparticles. P is the parity exchange. And if you've seen a talk by a B physics experimentalist, they'll often show you this triangle and tell you that what they're doing is they're measuring the apex of this triangle in as many possible different ways that they can, and thereby getting at elements of the CKM matrix, V, which is telling you coupling between different flavors in the standard model, different flavors in the weak interactions. You could use CP violating observables in the B to pi pi process to measure an angle in this triangle, and that's kind of interesting because the area of this triangle is actually a measure of CP violation. But to do so, you need to control the strong interactions, because if you were just to try to think about what it would look like, there would be some short distance weak interactions, but there'd be a big mess of strong interactions around it. It turns out that you can derive factorization theorems in this case, which also help you to organize the hadronic physics, and there's some universal functions that show up. And you can use that universality to make predictions. There's actually a very simple thing that you could do with it, and that's just use the strong phase information that comes out of those factorization theorems. You can use that to get rid of one of the parameters that you need in the analysis, and that's actually important because there's a measurement in the analysis which is poor. This is a measurement of the CPA symmetry of neutral pions, so the decay rate for B zeros to pi zero pi zero versus B bar zeros to pi zero pi zero. That's something that's related by CP, and the difference is a measure of CP violation, but the measurement is not so good. other measurements are quite nice. And you can use the factorization theorem to remove that measurement, not need it, and still calculate the weak phase of this process. And it actually agrees quite well with the global fit. Global fit is giving the number of 60 degrees, and within one sigma, it agrees with the value of gamma that you get out of just using it in the pi phi channel, agrees with it. The reason why you want to do this is because you don't want to just do global fits. You really want to look for deviations from the standard model. That means looking channel by channel and extracting information about gamma. If there was new physics in the beta pi pi decays, it could show up as a different value of gamma here. And so one would like to see these error bars decrease and these things stay apart. In this case, in order to do that, you need to understand the strong interactions, and we have tools to do that. Okay? These error bars will decrease by the end of the B factories, and actually this big error band here is experimentally dominated currently. There's other decays that one can look at. One that's very popular in new physics searches is BDS gamma. And in fact, there's effects here that are also important to take into account. The effect that comes about because of experimental cuts, making this X of S a jet-like state, is actually making the decay rate a little bit smaller than it otherwise would be. So subtracting it, and actually that takes it away, the standard model prediction away from the experimental prediction. So it's currently just outside the one sigma range once you take that into account. If you didn't take it into account, it would be within one sigma. In other rare decays, like beta SL plus L minus, there's a similar thing that happens. Once you take into account the cuts that experimentalists have to make, it changes the standard model prediction. It actually makes this X of S state jet-like. The experimentalists are only able to observe final states where the X of S is jet-like. And in that case, the decay rate is reduced. But using these methods, we can calculate that decay rate and still search for standard model effects, beyond standard model effects, in these loop-dominated processes where a B quark changes into a strange quark. So the type of diagrams that come into this process are the ones shown here. We have to have a loop involving a W boson or two W bosons, because we're making a transition from a neutral, from a down-type quark to another down-type quark. And those types of things don't happen at tree level in the standard model. Okay? So we want to study those effects because new particles could show up in these loops. But to do that, we have to understand all the gluons that I could address in these pictures. And one can do that and understand those effects at the level that is required to search for new physics in these processes. And that's a lot about what the B-factory program is doing, is to understand all the QCD effects and search for new physics on top of it. So there's lots of different channels that one can look at, and the future of the B-physics program. There's lots of things that are clean that I haven't talked about, where you can have the strong interaction effects cancel out by taking specially chosen ratios, and that's what the B-factories did first. And the end game in finding new physics is most likely going to be about whether we can understand the strong interactions well enough to see a new physics signal, and maybe we won't, and maybe we'll just have strong constraints in new physics models, and we'll have everything consistent with the standard model. That's how one might guess at the current stage of what's going to happen, but maybe we'll see something, some new physics channel in one of the things that we haven't measured quite well enough yet, but will by the end of 2008. Okay, so that's B physics. You can do other things besides B physics with this theory. There's lots of B decays that people have looked at, but you can also look at things like deep inelastic scattering in Drellian. And the future of this theory, I think, is going to be in the physics of the LHC, so jet production, in PP bar, I mean PP collisions at the LHC. So let me tell you a little bit about the future. Here's the LHC. If you ask who needs to understand QCD, well, these people are all pointing at you. To understand QCD is very important at the LHC. We have a PP collider, and it's going to just, with tons of energy, and it's going to, the events are very messy. There's a lot of QCD things to understand. If you want to pull out a signal, you have to understand jets, you also have to understand soft radiation, underlying events, all sorts of things. And it's very energetic QCD, so you might think that this effective theory that I've been talking about would help you. Somebody might disagree, and they might point somewhere else. So QCD at the LHC, a lot of it is focused on higher loops, calculations, and higher legs, because you have processes to be going to more final states. I'm not going to say much about that, but that's important. You could sum large logs, and the effective theory actually would help you in this second bullet to sum the large logs, because it helps you understand this resolution scale. It also is very important for understanding a standard model background, in particular definitions of jets and how that plays into observables, something that's not called plugged-on showering, which I'll describe to you in a second. And finally, just soft radiation. What you're going to see at the LHC is jets, because QCD, a very energetic quark, likes to form a jet. But some of the radiation won't be in the jets, and sometimes you might need to understand that as well. What are these plugged-on showers? Well, here's two examples, actually, where people have used these techniques that I've been talking about to understand LHC physics and try to go beyond the textbook description that we have of this type of physics, which is a very leading order description. In plugged-on showers, you're looking at the fact that you might collide two quarks together, produce some final states, but you're interested in a multi-plugged-on final state. Now, you can just calculate these Feynman diagrams and add them up, but at some level, as you start adding more and more final states, that becomes very inefficient. And you can actually use the fact that if close to its mass shell, there's just a probability function that describes the splitting of a quark into a quark and a gluon. Okay? And that's what's known as a plugged-on shell. And so in this picture over here, this blue curve is actually using plugged-on showers, a program called Pythia. And this red curve is actually just calculating the matrix elements. And at low energy, you really would like the plugged-on showers. And the blue curve is the correct curve. But at high energies, there's interference effects that make the red curve the correct curve. And what you'd like is a way of interpolating between them. And the effective theory techniques of SCT actually allow you to formally set that up and have both things at the same time in a systematic way, which has been a difficult thing to formulate in the past. Another thing that you might want to do is look at the top quark mass. The top quark has been measured to 1% accuracy at CDF and D0. And at the LHC, we're not going to do much better than that. We're going to get down to a 1 GeV. At least that's what the current projections are. If you want to get much below 1 GeV, you have to start asking difficult questions, like what exactly are they measuring when they say they're measuring the top quark mass? What mass is it? It's a quark mass in the standard model Lagrangian, and so it's a scheme-dependent concept. And if you ask what mass is it, the experimentalists will tell you it's a pole mass, and that's an ill-defined concept in QCD at below the 1 GeV level. And so even the concept of what it is that they're measuring has to change if the error bars are to come down a bit. And using effective theory techniques, we found ways of figuring out a mass scheme that they can measure in these jet events that is not ill-defined like the pole scheme, and can be measured with better accuracy than a GeV. We've also been able to use these techniques to understand things about soft radiation that you have to understand if you want to go below this 1% level measurement. And that's very important, actually, because precision electroweak physics really depends sensitively on the top quark. And even with this uncertainty that looks very small, we often have dominant uncertainties in electroweak physics coming from the uncertainty of the top quark mass. So let me conclude. We've done a lot. We've talked about QED, fundamental parameters, and precision quantum field theory using non-relativistic field theory to make predictions of very high precision. We've talked a lot about QCD. It's a very rich and diverse field. I talked only about a small part of it. And we talked about this effective field theory approach, which allows you to derive formulas which were difficult to derive before and allows you to go beyond what people have been able to do in the past by really systematically improving and treating power corrections for energetic hadrons as well as energetic jets. In B physics, I talked about some examples, measures of CP violation, use of hadronic parameters to make predictions. And QCD at the LHC physics, there's many examples where we'd like as precise control as possible about strong interaction effects. And the effective theory techniques will allow us to do that. There's a lot of theory and a lot of phenomenology here left to study, and it's going to be exciting. Thanks.
Yeah, when you were describing the effective theories for QCD,
yeah.
I didn't hear where you described. I mean, there's a question of what is the vacuum itself.
Yeah.
And doesn't that come in to some of these models like Galois-Fourier space? And how does it fit into the effective theory?
It does, and basically what I'm assuming about the vacuum is that the vacuum, I'm basically assuming that the vacuum is what we observe, so that we observe these states of hadrons. I'm basically ignoring the question of really determining what the vacuum is, saying I understand certain things from the data, I understand the spectrum of hadrons, and I'm going to take that as input and see what I can do with making predictions on top of that.
Well, for example, if somebody's bound state, or if there are these bag models,
yeah.
Couldn't there be degrees of freedom?
So there,
interaction with the bag, or
right, and so all of that is being lumped for me into the physics of the non-perturbative universal function, okay. And so if I actually wanted to go out and compute that universal function, then I would have to start asking questions like the ones you're asking. But if I just say it's a parameter that can be measured in one place and used in predictions in other places, then I don't have to ask that type of question. In the same way that you would have to ask that type of question if you wanted to measure the calculate the mass of the proton. What's the best way of doing it? But I'm actually asking a different set of questions, which are associated with, given that I can use this mass of the proton as a parameter, what can I do with it? And how can I organize things so that, given that I know the value very well from experiment, I can make a whole host of other predictions.
One should be able to justify that the universal function has the whole story of it.
Yes, and that you can do from the separation of scales. Because you've written down a set of degrees of freedom that are low energy, and whatever the model is for them, you've really got a QCD description of those low energy degrees of freedom. And so it has all the dynamics that, even if I can't calculate it, I have a Lagrangian that describes it, and it's non-perturbative, and it describes those functions that I have there, and I've separated systematically the effects of that low energy effective theory from the higher energy degrees of freedom.
So if you regard these bag things as higher energy?
These bag things are low energy degrees.
Yeah, so then.
So those things are in the, if you like, what's describing the low energy part of the problem is a QCD theory. And so if you believe QCD is the right theory, whether it produces bags or whatever it produces, it doesn't, you don't have to answer that question. You just say that you have QCD there for the low energy degrees of freedom. QCD in the gluon part of the Lagrangian.
You mentioned the alpha and when you showed up with the hydrogen atom.
Yeah.
I know that the alpha in the Josephson effect measurement is actually just a new disagreement on the Hall effect. And they're using helium, the type of this high structure of helium to
distinguish
which one is right. And so, how far has that progressed? Do people actually know if there's an agreement?
I actually don't know the answer of how far it's progressed. I am using the helium one.
Very generally. Can you give us a sense, sort of intuitively, why this, what's it called, SCET, why do things simplify in the kind of frame?
Yeah, sure.
Because it's really just a choice of frame, right? You could be doing
It's not really a choice of frame, okay, but it's so subtle, and it's a good question. So let me explain. So if I go back to this picture of deep and elastic scattering that I have, I picked a frame. Here. I picked the bright frame, although I didn't say it. And in the bright frame, the proton is collinear. Now, the important thing about SCET is not so much the one object by itself, but rather the interactions between objects. So those are frame independent statements. And so the important thing here is actually the interactions between this collinear sector and this hard sector. And that's a frame independent concept. If I was to go to a different frame in this problem, it would basically boost things along this line, which is a line in rapidity space. And so the separation between the degrees of freedom would always still be there. And that is the important part of the problem, because that's what actually is separating things into this hard function and this soft function that lives below the line. So no matter what I do with boosting, this guy will remain below the line, this guy will remain above the line, because the separation between those degrees of freedom really is in the invariant mass, which is a Lorentz invariant concept. And so even though I picked a frame, a particular frame, in order to put some dots on my momentum space diagram here, the actual results are frame independent. That's a good question.
So can you say intuitively what it is that does make the simplification?
Yeah, so what makes the simplification here is that really in QCD you're describing everything here as one big lump, okay? And now in SCET, what you're doing is you're picking different sectors, and you're saying, let me imagine that I have a process where I have different sectors like B to pi pi, where I have a collinear plan and maybe another collinear plan in the opposite direction. And by using different degrees of freedom to describe those two plans, I can really focus on the non-perturbative part of the problem, because the non-perturbative things that are binding together into one plan are living in this sector, and the non-perturbative things that are binding together in the other plan are living in this sector. And the things that are causing communication between them are typically living above this line, and are living in the hard interaction sector, and those I can describe perturbatively. If I was to just use QCD, I'm taking all those degrees of freedom in momentum space and combining them into just one field. Okay, so by splitting the field into different categories that focus my attention on particular pieces of momentum space, I'm actually able to simplify the problem, because I can focus more on the non-perturbative part, writing down an effective theory that gets the non-perturbative part right, and then just describe this hard physics with Wilson coefficients. And actually, this H function here is just a Wilson coefficient. If I were to write down operators, that's what it would actually be.
That's probably a good place to break then. So thanks very much, Ian. Thank you.